This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Normal police detective Nicole Bruno says consent education should focus on what sexual assault is rather than what it is not.
We've heard everything from, well, if they were flirting at the bar beforehand, then it wasn't a sexual assault. Well, it turned into a sexual assault the minute there was no consent.
Excuses. Mary Cullen reports it's often difficult to change minds on the definition of consent. Plus, Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason has hired a new assistant city manager, a diverse hire, a Harvard graduate, and one he's worked with before. Eric Stock talks about that and other issues facing the city. And the mayor of Normal stops by to talk about the Trail East project and other developments. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The town of Normal has moved ahead on a design concept for the Trail East project. Joining us to talk about that and other developments is Mayor Chris Koos. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Koos, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Good afternoon. By 5 minutes.
The Trail East project, your thoughts on the design concept just approved?
Actually, we did not approve a design concept. We got the input from the developer. We responded to it. The actual design review commission for the town of Normal will do the heavy lifting in terms of the design. And having said all that,
you generally signed off on it though and indicated approval in public comments.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty solid project. And as I said last night, it meets design guidelines in terms of massing and setbacks, the arcade, things like that, that are part of the master plan that dictate what buildings go around the circle.
So twinking around, though, with the idea of similarity in architectural feel, you're going to have three buildings now, Uptown One and Uptown Station and Trail East, that all really have the same sort of sensibility. Four, if you count the Children's Discovery Museum, although that has a little different vibe to it. Is that too many? Is that just right? Where do you cross the line between coherence and monotony?
Well, I think there's two things that are going on there. One, it was always envisioned that the buildings on the circle would have the arcade that is on Uptown Station and Uptown One. And that was a design concept from Farr & Associates as part of the master plan, where you'd have an area that people could walk around the circle out of the weather, sheltered. So that was an important part of the design. I think you also have to understand that, commercial building and that does tend to take a style, and a lot of that's driven by the economics of building buildings. And so, you're seeing a lot of buildings on the higher floors all over the United States with composite panels or metal panels on the second, third, fourth floor of the property, and that seems to be a design element. Now, we do not want it to be monotonous, so it has to be different enough from each other that it's not doing that, but it also has to be cohesive.
Here's the unfair question. Will this wear well? There are certain kinds of architecture that have really stood the test of time, and some of it really looks dated nowadays. Project out 30, 40 years.
I was going to say, ask me in 100 years what that would be. In terms of style, I think it's unique enough. It's not going to win national architecture awards, and it's not, I can't think of his name, but it's not, iconic architecture by any means.
It's not Frank Lloyd Wright. It's not
It's not
Sullivan.
It's not going to be the Guggenheim in Bilbao, Spain, but it's solid, dependable architecture, and I think it reflects well. And they try as much as they can in materials, especially at the ground floor, that reflect the older parts of our community.
Let's move on to the extra $800,000 in tax increment financing money that the town has decided to kick in.
A little over $700,000, but we won't banter.
Okay. Why is that necessary? Make the case.
Higher costs, larger square footage on the building, acquisition of the developer's acquisition, not ours, of 106 Beaufort. All those added into requiring a little extra addition. In the neighborhood, is, if you'll recall, from our finance director's comments last night, in the public-private partnership, we're about 15% of the equity stake in that project.
Is that too much? Is that too little?
Depends on who you ask.
Yes, it does.
And 15% tends to be right in the wheelhouse, or right in the sweet spot of public-private partnerships. Now, you know, I think it's important to say, and I didn't say it last night, part of our investment is to get higher quality buildings. I mean, without that investment, the buildings you'd see down there would not be as high quality because they simply don't pencil. We require a higher design standard around the circle and buildings in the uptown, and that's why we incentivize them.
The town is giving up some money, though, because of this. You're going to have to pay for the utility relocation costs rather than, you know, recoup them through TIF money. The town had planned on keeping some of the TIF money.
Well, I think the key of that is the TIF money. We were going to keep some of it, but again, the scope of the project expanded. We're going to have to do that, but without the project, none of these dollars would be spent.
Yeah, doesn't that cut against the no cash up front position the town had used before to help make the case for this project, though?
I mean,
so you're going to have to pay for the utility relocation rather than, and there will be no recoup on that. So that's outlay for the town.
Well, there actually will be a recoup on that.
How so?
In the sense of the success of the project and the dollars. You're right, but those dollars come out of TIF dollars. They don't come out of general fund dollars.
Development impact fees have been an issue from time to time. How is this different? Why shouldn't the developer pay the town for the utility costs to make it happen?
Well, because part of the utility costs are ours. There are things that we need to do to make that whole block work better. Wider alleys, undergrounding utilities is always a better solution. As we did to the front of the buildings, we replaced all the water mains and connections to the building.
Isn't this, though, a case of really bad imagery? The town says one thing and then the deal changes. Doesn't that lay you open to some criticism?
You know, in the sense that I will say every project we've done in the uptown has not been a cakewalk. You know, none of them have been that way. And projects change, and we have to change with them. Private projects face the same thing. Sometimes they go way over budget for things unexpected. There are projects in the uptown done by the private developers that came in a lot more expensive than they had anticipated. Those kind of things happen when you're developing property.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With us today is Mayor Chris Koos of the Town of Normal. Windy City Wieners will be a tenant of the Trail East project. Won't that compete with the food hall concept that is also going to be there?
I don't think so.
Why not?
I just don't think it will. I mean, where you have density of retail or density of restaurants, they help each other. Whether or not my sense of it is then in the food hall, there won't be a hot dog available in the food hall. I'm not saying there won't be, but my sense is there will not be. And that's an arrangement that the developer and Windy City Wieners worked out.
Okay. Sales tax receipts have been good for the third quarter, up significantly, while Bloomington was down because of mall closures. Why were Normal sales tax receipts so healthy?
We have not found out the answer to that. We've asked the state, and they said when you get the sales tax distribution, you'll get the explanation. But they did say it was a one-time event.
A one-time event?
A one-time event.
Don't count on that then. Okay. let's ask a couple of update questions. The first floor of Uptown One is still vacant. Is there any sign of movement on that?
Yes, there is. The developer has kind of stepped back and reanalyzing that. His initial idea was to put an 8,000 square foot restaurant on the ground floor. That did not work. He could not find a restaurateur to take that big a project on in Normal, Illinois. So he is looking at dividing the space into two spaces, and one will be a restaurant and one will be something else, which I'm not allowed to talk about.
Like what?
Like this thing I'm not allowed to talk about.
Well, what does the does Uptown need?
Not retail and not another restaurant. That's all I'll say.
How soon will that be coming to fruition at this estimated time?
In terms of fruition, that's hard to say. In terms of discussion, we're in active discussions with the developer on that right now.
Okay. Is the town going to be okay with half the space devoted to restaurant and half the space devoted to something not retail?
At this point, we think we are. But the devil's in the details, and until we get a further refined idea of what's going to happen there, I can't answer that.
Okay. How about the multi-sport complex? The clock is still ticking on the window of viability. When will that start to move publicly again or be decided? Rather?
Yeah, I think I'm not going to give you a time certain on that. The consultant group said that the study they did had an 18-month lifespan, and I think there's a number for you to look at in terms of when a decision has to be made. Staff is currently working on public-private partnership arrangements, meeting with private side developers who do this kind of work and having discussions to see what the viability of that is. So from the public side, nothing's happening, right? From the public side, nothing's happening. But from staff side, they're working very hard on this.
The city council campaign is ongoing. Are you coming closer to identifying who you support?
No.
No answers there, huh? All right. Mayor Chris Kuz, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas. The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Next week, we'll hear from Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org.
GLT comes from the CH3 Satellite Cafe, the boutique coffee shop from Coffee Hound nestled inside Bloomington Cycle, serving specialty handcrafted beverages. Open 7 to 5 Monday through Friday, 9 to 5 Saturdays, and 9 to 4 Sundays, with ample patio seating at 915 East Washington in Bloomington. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Eric Stock talks with the city manager of Bloomington. Too many people are learning misconceptions about sexual assault through TV shows. That's according to members of Normal Police Department's investigative unit. GLT's Mary Collins speaks with Lieutenant Paul Smith and Detective Nicole Bruno about how sexual assault allegations play out in the courtroom. Bruno says the public views sex crimes as different from victims of other crimes, and it's not in a good way.
You would never question the victim of a burglary or a robbery about what they were reporting, but it seems like what we've seen, or what I've seen through some of the cases that I've investigated, is that seems to be how those are viewed from the public. So they look at it as putting, you know, the victim on trial, or questioning the actions that the victim did, or saying that it didn't happen that way, whereas we don't see that rarely, if ever, in any other type of offense. So throughout investigating some of these and some of the outcomes at trial for the ones that went to trial, it was very concerning, you know, for us to notice that this was happening. And then even with law enforcement, the training that we've gotten on this topic has increased dramatically throughout the years, which is a good thing. Unfortunately, the public sometimes gets their education from TV shows, where it's the stranger in the bush or a very violent situation like that, where it's more than likely somebody that the victim knows. You know, it could involve substances, intoxication. So I think really the reason, you know, we see the need to educate the public is because the public is who's going to make up our juries. So they're going to be the decision makers when they see cases like this. So it's important to educate them on the reality of what these cases look like. And then also, in turn, obviously educate law enforcement, too, as we're the ones that are investigating it.
Right. So how do you see ways of educating?
You know, I think a lot of times education, especially nowadays, a lot of it is social media, public service announcements, and really just reaching out to your peer groups and having a discussion and starting a discussion on it is how we educate. You know, we don't obviously suggest you get your education from CSI when it comes to something like this, but actually coming to professionals who work in the field who have the direct knowledge would be better education for something like this.
To add to what Detective Bruno just said, I think that while we can certainly do education at the college level, sororities, fraternities, general public, we also have to start even younger than that. We are frankly seeing cases involving people in school, high schools. I think that if we start at that level, really reinforcing what we expect when those kids leave high school, move on to the military, move on to college, that we can then expect that they'll perform that way, and or that they've at least been trained and they understand the differences. It's not lost on me that you take that same age group and some kids go off to college and some go to the military, and we have problems in both of those environments with consent. So, you know, where do we go and how young do we go, I think, is a national conversation right now of, you know, do we train these kids in high school, junior high, so that they grow up with it and it becomes ingrained in them long before they ever see the first day at college or boot camp?
That's a really interesting strategy, is, you know, teaching the youth so that as generations progress, it becomes hopefully less and less of a problem. The other side of that is trying to focus on teaching those older generations who are more likely to be in a jury.
Absolutely. There's no doubt right now that you are going to see a very low representation of, you know, say 18 to 26-year-olds sitting a jury for many different reasons. They're in college, they're in the military, they're away, their names haven't made it into the database. Frankly, attorneys won't pick them out of that peer group. They'll pick more senior folks, people that are older, better educated, more life experiences. So we have to do both. I think, to your point, we need to start so that that change starts happening at the younger ages. But we also have to figure out how to reach our juries that are currently seated and those that are being selected right now, so that they have something else to bounce against the TV show or the detective story that they see on TV, that they know this is real and that it happens, you know, here in Bloomington Normal or Central Illinois in our community.
We've talked a lot about these narratives that people see play out on TV shows and maybe in books or stories that they read. And maybe let's focus on some of those misconceptions that people might have about sexual assault. For one, the idea that if you knew the person beforehand, there's no way it can be sexual assault. If you're in a relationship with that person, there's no way it could be sexual assault. If you're married, you don't get raped by your husband or your wife. So can we address some of those misconceptions and how we work to educate the public to see that those aren't always true?
Yeah, I would say just educating them on what is sexual assault versus focusing on what it's not, which would be the misconceptions. To change somebody's perspective, I think, is sometimes very difficult on something, especially a topic like this. But we've heard everything from, well, if they were flirting at the bar beforehand, then it wasn't a sexual assault. Well, it turned into a sexual assault the minute there was no consent. So it doesn't matter what happened before that or what the actions were before. We need to specifically focus on what actually happened in the actual assault part of it, which was when consent went out the door. So I think, you know, again, just having conversations about what misconceptions there are and kind of looking deeper, I guess, why we're having these misconceptions, like where are they coming from? And I've noticed in some of the cases that I've worked, some of them are coming from the victim's friends and family. You know, they might have reported or told them about what happened, and they get questioned by their friends and family, those that are there to support them. And going back to kind of the misconceptions and misunderstandings, I had a friend of a victim who actually told me that she thought that the incident was more of a sexual assault and not a rape. So to hear that, again, as a friend, I thought, well, what do you think is the difference? And they had no idea what the definition was.
We hear stories of men saying that they're afraid to go out and talk to women because they're afraid they're going to be accused of rape. Can we get into the definition of what consent is?
So the way they define consent in the Illinois statutes is it reads as consent means a freely given agreement to the act of sexual penetration or sexual conduct in question. Lack of verbal or physical resistance or submission by the victim resulting from the use of force or threat of force by the accused shall not constitute consent. The manner of dress of the victim at the time of the offense shall not constitute consent. Any person who initially consents to sexual penetration or sexual conduct is not deemed to have consented to any sexual penetration or sexual conduct that occurs after he or she withdraws consent during the course of that sexual penetration or sexual conduct.
So just to, you know, to answer the question and incorporate that, there needs to be an agreement to the affirmative that both parties are moving forward in a consensual manner. And, you know, to use the word consensual to define consent, it seems logical, but the reality is that both parties have to agree that they're moving forward and that they're going to have, you know, whatever conduct or relationship they're having. And I think that, you know, most of the time, you know, we hear from people that say, well, nothing was said, so yeah, good to go. Or, well, that person was passed out, so she never said no, or he never said no. Well, those, obviously that person can't consent.
So let's move on to a different issue is the statute of limitations. Can we explain what the statute of limitations is and how that kind of plays out in a rape case?
The statute of limitations generally is the state legislature sets limitations on each crime where prosecution can be taken. In sexual cases, there have been several variations of the laws over, you know, the last two decades, from a very strict statute of limitations to, in some cases now, you know, children coming forward can, you know, cases can be taken up decades after they were ever sexually assaulted.
Delayed reporting is very common in these cases and therefore should never be an indication that something didn't happen, which we hear a lot. Well, if they waited or how come they didn't report it? I find that delayed reporting of this crime is very common. Some of the things that make it a little bit more difficult in the investigation when it is a delayed reported case to us is we lose a lot of physical evidence. So depending on how long the delay is, if it's months or years, sometimes even, we would lose that piece of physical evidence. So although it is very common, sometimes that makes the cases a little bit more difficult to investigate and therefore obviously then get to court.
What we tell folks is that's why that initial report is so important, and it's extremely hard for a victim sometimes to come forward with that. You know, the process is not easy on the victim regardless of what happens, but we're able to get to a point very quickly where we can put the victim back in control of the situation. And if they need to take some time and deal with it, once we've preserved that initial evidence, once we've preserved everything we can, then the impact on the case is much less, and we can give them time and allow them to move through it at their pace and allow them to get back into decision-making position. And that's, you know, why from our standpoint, we attempt to get them to a point where we can look at them and say, okay, what do you want to do with this, and where do we need to go? And sometimes that is, I'm not ready to deal with this. And we respect that. And then we, you know, if that person comes back a year later, we're still in a good place to help them.
That initial evidence collection that you're talking about, I'm assuming you're talking about rape kits?
Rape kits, clothing, photographs, text messages, you name it. I mean, we live in a digital age. You and I can walk out of here, and I guarantee you by the time I could get to my car, I'm going to show up on a camera system somewhere. Frankly, if I can get to that evidence before that's rewritten, I can prove that I walked into this building today. If you wait a year, that probably isn't there. And it becomes very critical in our cases that we're able to look at that point in time and determine what evidence is available, and it's different in every case.
Illinois has a historically great backlog of rape kits. Can you give voice to how that presents an issue?
I would say with the backlog, it not only presents an issue for us working the case, but also presents an issue when we're trying to promote this safe space for the victims, that we want you to come forward and we're going to work these cases, and then they hear that it's going to take that long. That sometimes sends a message to them that their case might not be important, which is not the case at all. It's just, unfortunately, with the state of Illinois, it's not that they're not working them. It just doesn't, they don't have the resources to work the volume, I would say, that are coming in. So there's definitely a backlog, especially now with the changes where every sexual assault kit does go to the lab. So that's obviously increased.
And you might not have these numbers, but what does a wait list look like?
Well, I can tell you, you know, in this county, it's not uncommon for it to definitely take more than 6 months to get DNA evidence back. In the most, you know, in the horrible cases, it's taken over a year or longer.
Rape kits are very important evidence mm-hmm. when in the courtroom, and when there's not concrete evidence present, it's even more difficult when it comes to a rape case.
We've seen it before where that's what a jury expects, or that's what people expect. They expect there to be a DNA available, especially if there was a sexual assault kit done. But that's not always the case, and that doesn't mean that there was no sexual assault. So that misinformation is very unclear, I think, when that's, you know, expectation versus reality. It's the same thing with, you know, the crime scene. So if we go to the scene of where it happened and the crime scene's processed, if it's a case that was reported to us quickly, again, you might not have any physical evidence there. That doesn't necessarily mean that it didn't happen. It's just that sometimes there isn't any.
And this is definitely an area where, you know, TV really, for lack of a better term, handcuffs us. Detective Bruno touched on it. There are expectations that some jurors come in believing that I have a lab tech in the basement with ponytails like NCIS and that she can turn a DNA sample around to me in the next 5 minutes. And, you know, frankly, those people don't exist. I can't say that often enough. So the reality is until we get to that point where people understand that, you know, that evidence will not always be there, that we will have to rely on more traditional witness statements, video, maybe even, you know, new evidence, text messaging, GPS data, different things to prove our case, it does hinder that, because people believe that without that, that maybe this isn't true. And, you know, of course, they exercise that in the jury pools when they go back to vote.
Normal Police Lieutenant Paul Smith and Detective Nicole Bruno speaking with GLT's Mary Cullen. Last year, NPD announced Be the Change, a public awareness campaign aimed at ending sexual assault victim blaming by building strong, educated support systems.
It starts out as a flicker, just a glimpse of an idea, maybe a question. But then the GLT newsroom works the phones, checks into it, and it turns out it's more than an idea. It's a good idea. What's life like for a candidate after losing an election?
Just because you lose an election doesn't necessarily mean that you don't keep making progress.
From idea to story to your eyes and ears, this is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Follow GLT News at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. GLT's award-winning online presence brings you news when it happens, day and night and on weekends. Join the community of users ready to discuss GLT's thoughtful, in-depth reporting and breaking news. Recognized by the Illinois Associated Press for best digital presence, this is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason has brought his former second-in-command from Decatur to join him in Bloomington. But Gleason tells GLT's Eric Stock he was surprised Billy Tyus applied for the city's new deputy city manager post.
The fact that he was the number two in Decatur and had been filling the interim city manager position in my vacancy. I knew that he had notified the city that he was not interested in being their next city manager. It's because I knew he wanted to move on. He has a couple of younger kids that are grade school age, and it was a perfect time for his family.
You recently restructured this position from an assistant city manager post, which oversaw certain departments, to this new format, which is more of a chief of staff. Do you feel that that made the position more attractive? You had about 30 applicants nationwide. Did that sort of sweeten the pot, so to speak, for those who might have been interested in this job?
Well, I can't speak for Billy. I know, you know, that I felt that being a true number two in an organization. I mean, we're an organization that has an all funds budget of $220 million. It's a larger community, including the town of Normal and the universities. It is a great opportunity for somebody out there. And even when we conducted the search, we attracted people coast to coast, you know, and there was a lot of interest. A lot of people met the qualifications, and then you have the preferred qualifications, and there was a fair amount that met that. I created an interview team that was made up of Fire Chief Brian Moore, Public Works Director Jim Karch, HR Director Nicole Albertson, and Finance Director Scott Rathbun. And we interviewed five candidates, and Billy truly emerged as the clear front runner to offer a job to.
From your time working with him in Decatur for those 3 years, are there particular projects or initiatives or passions of his that stand out to you that you see him bringing to Bloomington?
He has a very strong background in economic development and also, community revitalization was there and very active in the downtown revitalization in Decatur. And it's a number of those things that I think are going to fit very well here. And then in the deputy city manager position that he stepped into in Decatur, he became, you know, he had a broader knowledge and working understanding of the entire organization.
Now, Mr. Tyus is African American, and he joins a city administration that is fairly light in terms of its diversity, particularly in leadership positions. Was that a factor in this decision, and is that a concern that there is not much diversity in city administration?
I've heard I've heard that, but I will say that the selection of Billy, it was entirely on what he brought to the table. Color of his skin, you know, was not consideration. He is a great candidate that could have been a number one most anywhere in the United States.
Is there a concern that there are not many minorities in positions of leadership in the city, or is that just something that you take case by case?
I think it's case by case. I've heard that stepping into this position. I left a position where my direct reports, I actually, the majority of my direct reports in Decatur were minority. And those, many of those were my selections. And again, the selections were based on I needed the best person out there, and that's what I got.
Billy Tice comes in as essentially chief of staff, as we have talked about. As you restructure this position, do you feel that, not that anyone is running you out, but do you feel that this prepares Billy Tice or anyone who would have filled in that position to eventually become city manager? Would that make for a more seamless transition if that were to happen at some point down the road?
Totally, Eric. That's exactly, I feel, one of my greatest responsibilities as city manager is to make sure that there is seamless transitions in the director-level positions, and then also in mine if I was to leave. And that's exactly what I did for the city of Decatur. I positioned them to reach out and appoint that deputy city manager, but it's not what Mr. Tice wanted in the city of Decatur.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason. You've been on the job in Bloomington for nearly 6 months now after coming from Decatur. How do you feel it's going so far?
Very well. Really excited about some of the ground that we've covered already and where I think we're headed as a community.
Well, there's a lot for a top administrator to learn in an organization of nearly 700 employees working in dozens of different departments. You have to figure out what's working, what's not working, what could be done better, deciding what gets done first, what can wait, and then you have, of course, an elected body, 10 members who have to sign off on a lot of major business. So where are you in that process of putting your stamp on the city?
Well, I don't know that I approach it putting my stamp on it. I like to sit back and observe where I can, but a couple of things that I definitely had to hit the ground running quickly is the upcoming budget and the current budget that we're operating in. Get a very good handle on that. Get to know the elected officials, even though I also know that we're likely to have some new faces next spring or this coming spring, and then also getting to know my department directors.
So as you alluded to, potentially three or more new council members to join the city council starting in May. Since you are getting up to speed in your first year on the job, how much of a concern is that to have that much transition in such a short amount of time, or do you see that as a positive?
I think, you find the silver lining in anything. I think we've got a great opportunity here. I've met most of the candidates that have, thrown their hat in the ring to run. One thing that I will do after the election and they take their seats at the council is I'll do a newly elected orientation where, explain to them what their role is as an elected official, but also likely a Saturday morning type session where introduce my department directors to all of them. Allow the directors to share a little bit about themselves and their departments, and then I'm thinking I wouldn't mind loading everybody up on a bus and showing some of the major city facilities that they should be aware of, and also visit some of the areas that we see opportunities and challenges throughout their community.
Certain places you have in mind?
Yeah, some of the development opportunities that we see, and then also some of the areas on the west side of the community are some of those where I think have been identified as challenges, but also believe that we have some opportunities there as well.
As you referenced the budget, and you're getting to work on that here soon, the city's finance director, Scott Rathbun, had recently reported to the council in December that the financials for nearly the end of 2018 had come out surprisingly strong, close to $1 million in tax revenue above expectations for the year. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I think extremely conservative approach to the current fiscal year budget that we're in now. And nothing wrong with that. We also have seen an increase in some of the revenues. So what's your projections? And actually, my approach to the budget, and it's working very well, with the finance director, Scott Rathman, is obviously to be conservative. But if we've got historical data that we can show the past 3 to 5 years and we see these kinds of revenue trends or we see other kinds of trends, then that's going to be what our projection is for the FY20 budget.
And last year, the city made pretty considerable cuts in some services, particularly public works, an increase in fees to balance the last budget before your arrival here. Do you see that changing this year based on those tax revenue projections that ended up being very conservative and you ended up exceeding those?
I think our approach for FY20 is that things are shaping up very well, trying to accomplish, the different expense items that are necessary, not to kick the can down the road and end up compiling, becoming an even bigger problem if we don't address them sort of as we go. Revenues are going well enough for the community, which is a positive. I'll take that right now. And we're shaping up. It looks as if we're going to have about a $500,000 surplus in the FY20 budget that will come before council in March for approval.
Could some of that money be a return to the taxpayers?
I think what likely, yes, first off, is the answer to your question, but I think what likely will occur is there is a list of capital projects, that arguably need to be done. And that's not an ongoing number, but it is, in fact, $500,000 that could be, identified as a funding mechanism for some of these projects.
O'Neill Pool is certainly one of them.
That's a biggie, and that is what we're doing is we're limping through the 2019 season, doing the bare minimum repairs so that we can open that pool. A longer-term decision is going to have to be made, and that's something that council is going to have to address.
And as we continue with Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason, the city proposed last year doubling the gas tax from 4 to 8 cents, arguing that it would raise an additional $2.3 million for infrastructure. The council didn't want to do that. Is that something that you would entertain this year, or do the numbers make that not necessary?
Definitely. That's going to be on what I call my menu of options to the council to consider for new revenue streams. For every penny that we have that we bring in locomotive fuel tax, that equals about $575,000 in revenue, new revenue. But what I would also propose, when we're talking about new revenues and the possibilities to fund some of the capital projects, I also like the idea of tying that new revenue stream to a specific type of projects. And also not opposed to the idea that we actually put a sunset provision in any of these revenue streams. And really that's for the community to realize that this is not a new revenue stream that's going to get lost in the general fund and be foolishly spent by government. I'm very conscientious to that, no different than any other taxpayer in the community. So it's very important to me that when we're talking about any taxpayer dollars, but especially new revenue, that the community have a great understanding of what this money is going to be used for.
So do you have in mind where that money would go specifically?
Yeah, we definitely have possibilities. Investment into the downtown has been discussed in various different ways. The O'Neill Pool is a consideration. And some other stuff that's out there as well.
Well, until May, you have the same council that was in place last year. What will be the difference for them to come on board when last year they were leery during a tougher budget year?
I look forward to, we've had some of these discussions, but we're actually at the Committee of the Whole meeting that will be on Tuesday the 22nd, a day later because of Martin Luther King holiday. Will be the first public discussion where we're truly talking about the FY20 budget. So this is different than the finance director's monthly report. And then we'll take the council members into three-on-one meetings, not to violate the Open Meetings Act. and have some further discussion that I'm sure will either be presented in a special meeting or the committee of the whole meeting in February.
And a gas tax increase would be a part of that discussion then?
Yeah, it definitely is. And there's a couple of other areas, you know, not necessarily that, you know, that's the thing is I'm not proposing that we do any of this. I just feel that it's my responsibility to balance a budget, that we live within our means. But there has been this, you know, public discussion about some of the capital projects that the city would like to do, needs to do. And in order to do those, we need to create new revenue streams. So with that discussion having occurred in the community, I feel that it's my responsibility to throw out those options, you know, that menu of options on new revenue streams.
Well, and there's also talk of doing that at the state level. In fact, a measure could come forth as early as today as the new legislature gets back to work in Springfield, a gas tax for infrastructure. How much might that be of help to a community like Bloomington?
I think I have to see how that plays out. I know the interstate system is something that that money would likely be used for, and I've got local roads that state motor fuel tax doesn't touch.
And Governor-elect J.B. Pritzker has said that he's going to prioritize getting a new capital bill passed to repair the state's crumbling roads and bridges. One of his transition teams was formed to address that. And we spoke recently with Normal Mayor Chris Coos, and he said he's a little concerned that the team lacks much local representation, specifically for Central Illinois, to truly assess our infrastructure needs. Is that a concern that you share? And how might the Pritzker administration change how Bloomington could potentially benefit?
Well, I think the elected officials here at the municipal level, county level, and then our state representatives, we're going to have a constant voice in Springfield and, you know, make sure that we're heard with the new administration. And I'm cautiously optimistic, as I, you know, typically am. I think it's one where we have to show why this investment in our communities, you know, Bloomington Normal, is a good return on investment and how it can grow the economic base statewide. And I think we've got a good story to tell, but we got to make sure that we're in Springfield consistently sending that message.
And as we continue with Tim Gleason, the Bloomington City Manager, the city will have an option to opt out of its contract with Venue Works in April, the firm that the city hired to run Grossinger Motors Arena 3 years ago. How is Venue Works doing, and is that option still on the table?
Yeah, definitely. It's still on the table. We think Venue Works is doing a good job. When Lynn Cannon is the manager for Venue Works, I think it would have been in August. I had about a month on, and she's presenting, you know, the financials for Venue Works. One thing that was said is that the city and the community should start accepting the fact that you're going to run at a $500,000 loss. After the meeting, you know, I was interviewed, and I thought, wow, that's, you know, unacceptable to, you know, to accept a $500,000 loss. And I didn't realize, you know, the full backstory. But then I had a couple of elected officials and even a couple of my department directors that said that was not what was discussed when Venue Works was being brought on. And this was prior to Lynn Cannon being, you know, the manager. So this is not on Lynn at all. I think another thing, and it's just a position that the city was put in, you know, coming out of the previous management firm, you know, we were sort of scrambling to, you know, we found as a community, we were scrambling to find someone. So maybe the contract, while it was the right thing to do at the time, it's also a perfect time to review and make sure that it's meeting the needs of the community. Something that I have said is a possibility, and there is some interest out there from different entities of owning, you know, the arena. And actually, they're being a purchase from the city. You know, not saying that that's a good idea or it's really gained too much traction, but really what I'm trying to share is that all options are on the table.
So you are satisfied with how they're doing so far, but potentially someone could come in and run it better, sounds like.
And that's a perfect way to say it, Eric, is, you know, while we're satisfied, are there greater, better opportunities out there? And they might possibly be.
Is there desire in the council? We see it quite often when we report on the financial losses, since it was not initially presented to the public as a revenue drain. Is there appetite in the council to simply wash its hands of it, turn it over to a private company, and walk away?
Yeah, I think you know, that is a viable option. You know, even if the arena was sold for less than what the remaining debt is on that building, and our remaining debt, bond debt, is $22 million, and it pushes out to, you know, like 2033 or 2034, we can make the numbers work if we sold it for less than what that debt was. The thing that I think is unfortunate for the current elected officials is this decision that was made many years ago, prior to many of these council members, it's almost a stranglehold is how I would describe it on them when we're trying to consider new opportunities for the community, because everybody points to the arena. And it's, you know, it's just something that this current council has inherited, and we have to deal with it.
That was Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason with GLT's Eric Stott. Ames, Iowa-based VenueWorks took over management of what was then known as U.S. Cellular Coliseum in April of 2016. The company reported a $665,000 operating loss in the last budget year, which ended last April. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. WGLT.org is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen and Eric Stock. And thanks to Mayor Chris Koos of Normal for stopping by. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.